We'll open the hearing of the Senate Committee on Healthcare Human Services Rural Health Policy Subcommittee on Healthcare Reform. First item on the agenda today will be an adoption of committee rules.
All right. Chair Morris, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated January 12, 2011.
Senator Mona Sanderson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated January 12, 2011. Is there any discussion? Hearing none. Without objection? Adopted. Okay, we've done that.
I think we have to have roll call.
Oh, excuse me. Oh, roll call for the adoption. Well, folks, this is my first committee chairmanship.
So, I already screwed it up.
Yeah, I know. And it'll go uphill from here, I'm sure. Would the clerk call the roll, please?
Senator Bates?
Here.
Senator
Wallace
Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Morris?
Aye. Motion passes. Rules are adopted.
2-1, 2 in affirmative and 1 present, I believe. So.
Okay, well, we have on the agenda today open an informational hearing.
Actually, we're going to do the public hearing.
The
public hearing first.
Oh, you want to do the public hearing first?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, technically close the informational hearing and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 96, which expands the list of health professional regulatory boards that are subject to health care. Would you care to comment on the nature of the bill?
I think you said it, but Senate Bill 96 expands the list of health care professional regulatory boards that are subject to health care workforce data reporting to the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research.
And we have testimony. We have two persons to testify. Would Ann Malash and Sean Comer, please? And if I have mispronounced your name, did
just
I come
perfect.
Close?
Malash.
Malash. Okay, thank you.
And the written testimony should be in everybody's packet as well.
Whichever first, please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Morris. Members of the committee, for the record, Sean Comer, Deputy Administrator of the Office of Health Policy and Research in the Oregon Health Authority. First, thank you for having us as your first, and hope it is uphill from here. Wanted to talk with you today about Senate Bill 96. As you have in front of you are written testimony, but I wanted to sort of highlight a couple of pieces for you before turning it over to Ann Malash, who was Vice Chair of the Policy Board's Healthcare Workforce Committee. So, in essence, Senate Bill 96 allows the authority to include most of the healthcare professionals that are currently licensed in the state of Oregon. As you may recall, most of you all worked on this in the 2009 session as part of Senate Bill 497, and then which ultimately got rolled into House Bill 2009. Our office has spent the last 2 years working with seven professional licensing boards to collect and use them as infrastructure to collect healthcare licensing data for policy, for policymaking, evaluation, and planning. Currently, we have seven regulatory boards participating. Those boards are the Oregon Medical Board, State Board of Nursing, Board of Dentistry, Board of Examiners of Licensed Dietitians, Occupational Therapy, Physical Therapy, and the Board of Pharmacy. And those were explicitly laid out in statute in House Bill 2009. Why this data is valuable for what we have and what we hope to get in Senate Bill 96 is right now, if we use information from, say, surveys, as an example, it gives us an incomplete picture of what the real workforce is. Another example that I use is my boss, who most of you know, Janine Smith, is a licensed physician in the state. If we look at the medical examiner's list of licensees, she looks like a full practicing practitioner. But all you all know, you saw her last night from 6 to 9. You see her here. She only practices 4 hours a week. And in workforce planning, it's really important to understand not only who's licensed, but whether they're practicing, seeing patients, where they are, what kind of patients they're seeing, what kind of facilities they're practicing in, so you all and others can decide what workforce policies make sense for the delivery system of the future. The concept for Senate Bill 96 is in the Action Plan for Health adopted by the Policy Board that you all received and was the work that Ann will talk about in the Workforce Committee. What the bill does is it expands the authority of the health authority to include 11 new boards that represent 16 additional professions. Those professions include psychologists, social workers, professional counselors, therapists, naturopaths, chiropractors, optometrists, and some medical imaging professionals, among others. The bill does not specify when those boards would participate, but allows us to have those conversations and work with each of the boards based on policy direction and also their readiness to help facilitate the data exchange and collection for the work that you all and others need to do. So in closing, we think that this information is important for the planning that's ahead of us, especially in thinking about delivery system reform and team-based care, especially if you're thinking about the primary care home model work, how we need professionals across the licensed professionals in the state to work together to provide better care. Thank you for having me. As always, more than happy to answer any questions or provide any additional information you might need about this, and I'll pass it on to Ann.
Well, Senator Morrison, members of the subcommittee, good afternoon. My name is Ann Malosh, and I am Dean of Business, Healthcare, and Workforce at Lynn Benton Community College. I'm also Vice Chair, as Sean mentioned, of the Health Policy Board's Workforce Committee, and I'm here in the latter capacity to support Senate Bill 96. The Oregon Healthcare Workforce Committee was created by the passage of House Bill 2009, and it was charged to coordinate efforts to recruit and educate healthcare professionals and retain a quality workforce in Oregon to meet the demand for care. 24 educators, healthcare professionals, and industry employers were appointed to the committee and met throughout 2010 to prepare recommendations to the Health Policy Board. In developing recommendations, the committee identified three priority areas. The first was preparing the workforce for new models of care delivery. The second was improving the capacity and distribution of the primary care workforce. And the third was expanding the workforce through education, training, and regulatory reform to meet the projected need for providers. The committee depends on accurate and timely workforce information to develop and implement strategies addressing each of these three priorities. For example, information about the educational background of current professionals is needed to identify potential gaps that must be addressed to allow professionals to work together in new ways, perhaps as members of interprofessional teams. Similarly, information on the future practice plans of provider types is necessary to help identify where and what kind of additional capacity will be needed. For these reasons, the Workforce Committee strongly recommended expansion of the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Database in its 2010 report to the Health Policy Board. Participation in Oregon's healthcare workforce database is currently limited, as John mentioned, to 7 professional licensing boards, meaning that the Health Policy Board, our committee, and other policymakers lack information on key shortage professions such as those providing mental and behavioral health services. Furthermore, legislation governing the database is not flexible enough to include new provider types that may be recognized by professional licensing boards in the future. Senate Bill 96 would address both these issues by extending participation in the workforce database to almost all health professional licensing boards, and including all professionals licensed by those boards. The committee advised a flexible timeline for expansion with new boards to be added to data priorities and board readiness. However, the committee did recommend starting with the boards governing licensed mental health and behavioral health care professionals, since these professionals are central to patient-centered medical homes and other emerging models of integrated care delivery. Complete and accurate information about Oregon's healthcare workforce is essential to design and evaluate for the design and evaluation of workforce development strategies. Thank you for the opportunity to present to you, and I'd be happy to answer any of your questions. And on a personal note, this clarity, this full picture, would certainly help me look in my crystal ball as I try to decide where to put programs and how to staff programs and where our graduates should practice.
Well, thank you very much. Colleagues, any comments or questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, just when I first was reading the bill, I was reading the black, and I was wondering why we'd be adding the mortuary and cemetery board. That would be a little bit too late, I would think.
If we don't do our other part right, we'll have to expand them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering, will the boards then solicit, when the licensing's for the data that is needed, has the board's given you any feedback as to the costs or how they would implement that and get that information?
Chair Morrison, Senator Mona Sanderson, the way that it currently works is OHA has rulemaking authority, and we do it in collaboration with the boards because they have their own rulemaking process they need to go through. And as we talk about how we stage these groups in, then we talk about what it's going to take. Most of these boards already collect most of the data that we need or that we would want for policymaking. There's a lot of information they currently collect that we don't have any interest in, disciplinary being one of them. But it was a different story for each board. For example, the Board of Nursing was ready to go and had everything we needed, and so the cost for them was a little bit different than, say, for the Board of Physical Therapy, where it took them a lot of effort and time to get it in a state to submit it to us so we could make apples-to-apples comparisons.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Bates.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm assuming that you're going to, the intent of this initially was to find out geographic distribution of these health care providers, their age, so we're looking at retirement issues, to a certain degree, whether they're part-time or full-time, or whether they're licensed in multiple states and weren't even practicing in our state. When we asked that about physicians and some others, we didn't know those answers. The boards had not kept that kind of information because it wasn't germane to what they were doing at that time. Most of these situations are on a two-year rotation. A few of them might be on an annual, but I think most of them are on a two-year rotation for licensure. So my expectation is we're not going to get this information probably for another year or two, I would guess, but I'd like to know where you are in that process and how much information you're gathering, and if you're getting those key markers, age, geographic distribution, and whether it's part or full-time, since one of us here is obviously part-time.
Yeah, Chair Moore, Senator Bates, that's exactly the type of information we're going to have, and we're in the final stages of finalizing our report that has the first round of data in it. So we're going to have county-by-county profiles of professionals that are practicing, that are licensed. So we're going to have that type of information, so we'll share it for you as soon as it's ready.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or comments?
Is there a fiscal to this?
That was my question as well.
We have not received a fiscal for this yet, no.
So whether it's referred to Ways and Means will depend on that fiscal.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
Senator Bates. My questionable memory on this was that this was going to be part of the duties of the individual licensing boards to gather this information is something that is not required by the health authority, but really when they're looking at their profession, they should have this information anyway. Most of this was going to be captured by their own funds. And I don't know if that's true or not, and I'd like to hear a discussion of that real quickly.
Chair Moore, Senator Bates, the current data system is a fee-based system. So our office assesses fees that essentially the board passes on to their licensees to support the program and the authority that the legislator gave us to do that. We haven't necessarily priced expansion because we haven't had those conversations with the boards because their fiscals are different than what might be for us. We're not anticipating as an agency a fiscal on this bill, but that might be different than what the board might tell you.
This genesis of this was started back in, what was it, in the interim of 8, I believe, and there was a lot of work done with the stakeholders and brought forth a measure. Could you speak to those boards and members that will be coming into this with respect, because I only see two people, both of you, to testify. Is there anyone that's unhappy?
Chair Morse, we have not heard that. I actually had a meeting with the executive directors of all of the licensing boards last week. And although they have the concerns that any board has when you're adding responsibilities, they all seemed like that this was something they could handle. But you'd have to ask them. But we haven't heard anything other than that.
Okay, well, I'll assume that their absence is an indication of acceptance. So, any other questions or comments? Thank you very much, Sean.
Thank you for
coming today, and we'll be bringing this back. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 96 and open an informational hearing, and we will be inviting Teresa Miller and Anthony Behrens. And while they're coming, I would like to acknowledge our guests, Senator Shields and Representative Hoyle and Representative Greenlick. We had extended the invitation to the House members and those in the Senate that would like to join us in our deliberations, and we certainly welcome that, and I'm glad you're here. And the colleagues that are not here but would like to be in the future would like to make sure, Representative Greenlick, that they have that invitation as well.
We expect that Representative Kenmer and Representative Widener will be joining us once they clear the schedule. With Representative Hoyle and me, sort of our group.
Okay, great.
Yep. Thank you for the welcome.
Glad you're here. We'll look forward to your participation. Who is going first?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Teresa Miller. I am the administrator of the Insurance Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I thought I would go ahead and walk through a presentation. I have with me Anthony Behrens, who is our health expert and knows more about the Affordable Care Act, certainly, than I do. And so to the extent there are questions that come up that I can't answer, I'm going to be looking to him. So, okay. So one of the primary goals of the Affordable Care Act is to reduce the number of uninsured Americans. And to accomplish this, the federal law significantly expands Medicaid, includes a requirement that most people purchase insurance beginning in 2014, and makes insurance more affordable by providing subsidies and tax credits to individuals and small businesses who buy insurance through the exchanges that will be put in place in 2014. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about the State Insurance Division's role in reform, some of the immediate changes that took effect beginning in September of last year, and many of those are incorporated into Senate Bill 89 that is before this committee. And then I'll just talk briefly about some of the key reforms that will start in 2014, which are not incorporated in Senate Bill 89. So the federal health reform law really created a state-federal partnership. The law provides new federal minimum standards but leaves the primary responsibility of enforcement to the states. If states fail to enact standards that meet the federal requirements, then the federal government will step in and enforce the law. A good example of this was with the high-risk pools last year. There were about 22 states or so that didn't implement high-risk pools, so the federal government stepped in and implemented those high-risk pools in those states. Oregon, obviously, was not one of those, but that just gives you a sense of how the law will work. The Insurance Division reviews and approves rates in the individual small group markets in Oregon and has the authority under existing state law to reject unreasonable rates in these markets. And I'll briefly mention later federal law relating to unreasonable rates, but for now I'll just simply say that there's nothing in the federal law that interferes with our current authority to approve or deny rates in the individual and small group markets. And finally, I just want to point out that the Insurance Division has consumer advocates that are available to help people with any insurance problems they have. Senate Bill 89, which again is before this committee, makes the bulk of the changes needed for Oregon to comply with the provisions of the Affordable Care Act that are already effective. And it also gives the department the explicit authority to enforce federal law. Senate Bill 89 was drafted so that we wouldn't have any conflicts in Oregon law with the new federal law, but we did not include every provision of the federal law in Oregon law. So that was kind of our approach to the legislation. Because the federal law is ever-changing, as federal officials continue to issue and revise regulations and guidance detailing and clarifying the law, we've been working very closely with both the federal government and our National Association of Insurance Commissioners to track all of this new additional guidance as it's coming out, and are currently working with legislative counsel on amendments to this legislation that incorporate some of that new guidance that we're receiving. And again, there will be more changes in 2013 before the key federal reforms take place in 2014, assuming, of course, that there's no changes to the federal law. So now I just thought I'd run through some of the key new benefits and consumer protections that became effective September 23rd, 6 months after the president signed the federal reform law, and many of these are incorporated into Senate Bill 89. The new federal law requires insurance companies to allow adult children to stay on their parents' plan until age 26. This was one of the most popular provisions of the bill, I think, and a lot of folks have been talking about it. Oregon's largest health insurers, as well as many national carriers, extended this coverage early before it was required by the law, and in many cases, that happened last summer. So this has been in effect for a while for many carriers. And you'll note that this coverage applies to children who are married, children who are not dependents on a parent's tax return, and there's no requirement that children be a student or currently attending school.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
What if can the spouse of a son or daughter be on it, or just the daughter or son? I mean, so it says you can be married or unmarried, so if your daughter is married, then can the husband be on it too if they're under 626?
Senator Morris Anderson, I believe that a spouse isn't necessarily allowed under this provision.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. So our job is to ensure that insurance policies that come before us for review right now contain this provision. Another new benefit that has received a lot of media attention is the provision requiring insurance companies to cover kids. Immediately following passage of the bill, there was a lot of discussion about whether insurance companies had to cover all children or whether they just had to provide immediate coverage of children who had pre-existing conditions and cover those conditions. And it was determined through federal regulation that insurers could no longer deny coverage to children, and they couldn't make them wait for coverage of pre-existing conditions either. In the Oregon market, children historically could be turned down for health reasons, although they could buy coverage through our high-risk pool, OMIP, Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. So these children cannot now be rejected based on health status, but federal officials did allow insurers to limit applications to open enrollment periods to deter parents from seeking insurance only when children become ill, which then drives up coverage for everybody, or the cost of coverage for everybody. The department, when this new regulation came out, the department responded quickly to this guidance and adopted emergency rules last year, which have now become permanent, that established two open enrollment periods in Oregon, and those periods are the months of February and August. Employer plans in Oregon are already prohibited from denying coverage to employees or dependents based on health. So the significance of this provision in the employer market is simply that children under 19 get immediate coverage of pre-existing conditions. In the past, pre-existing condition waiting periods could be imposed. And of course, in 2014, when most people are required to have insurance, insurers will no longer be able to deny coverage based on health conditions. Lifetime dollar limits on essential benefits have been eliminated, and annual dollar limits on essential services are phased out over a three-year period. And these new requirements are effective when a plan renews on or after September 23rd of last year. And we're awaiting guidance from the federal government on further definitions of essential benefits and what that means.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I had heard about some insurers dropping kids altogether from their plans. Is that happening or not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, we do have a couple of carriers who have decided not to sell child-only coverage. There's no dropping of kids who are currently covered, but they've just decided no longer sell child-only coverage.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Bates.
It may be too early to answer this question, but are you seeing an influx of ill children with chronic illnesses or acute expensive illnesses into the insurance market, and others who are healthy staying out? Are we seeing the kind of shift that we've been concerned about, or is that just not really happening?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, it's a good question. I don't know. I'd have to reach out to the carriers and talk to them individually about what they're seeing. I don't know that we've seen that yet. This has only been in effect for a couple of months, really, so I don't know that they've seen. So I don't know exactly what they're seeing. This is something just for the committee to know that we've been working, the department's been working very closely with the carriers on this to see if we can find a way to encourage carriers, all carriers, to be in this market and to sell child-only policies. So you may, depending on how these conversations go, you may end up seeing a bill this session that would try to address that issue.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
You said an open enrollment's of February and August, which struck me as kind of strange. Most carriers, it's towards the end of the fiscal year, November, December, or of that time. How'd you pick February and August? And did you pick February because we're just opening up session today and you just wanted to nail it? What was the plan here?
Sure, Mr. Chair, Senator Bates. We coordinated some of that with Healthy Kids, and then also they have, I believe theirs is from, I want to say, January 15th, February 15th, and August 15th, September 15th. And there was talk about August being a good month because of the end of summer and people were preparing for school, and so there was that notice, and then February was not a lot was happening for people, so that was something they could pay attention to.
Mr. Chair, just to comment, we may want to look at this enrollment things all over the map, and it makes it very difficult for a consumer to look at this and decide which one's going where. It's just one of those glitches in the system we may want to think about.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, just on that note, if the conversations that we're having with carriers result in legislation, the enrollment periods would go away. So just, but we'll see how that goes.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, and if I may, we did have several conversations with stakeholders establishing these enrollment periods, and so we did talk to insurers about those and consumers, and it's kind of all an agreement.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah. For those children who are in the foster care system, just remind me how they are covered. You're not under that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, I don't know, and I don't know if anybody from the Oregon Health Authority would know the answer to that, but I'm sorry, I don't know.
No, that's all right. I'm still getting back to insurers dropping child-only, covering children, just having child plans, and if it's not relevant to this, then that's...
Foster care is covered under Medicaid.
It varies with their income levels are.
They are. They go into the... Okay. No problem. I can find that out.
I apologize.
Sorry, Teresa. Okay.
That's all right.
Yeah, but she's talking about people in foster care, some of which may have income levels.
Right. Go on. Okay. The new law requires coverage of certain preventative benefits with no cost sharing. There's been some confusion around this provision because it doesn't apply to all plans. The provision applies to people enrolled in job-related health plans or individual health plans that fall into the category of what we call non-grandfathered plans, or those plans that were sold after March 23, 2010. This requirement doesn't apply to people who have what we call a grandfathered plan or a plan that existed before March 23rd, before passage of the bill last year. So we've gotten a lot of calls in our consumer advocacy unit from people who don't understand why they're not getting this benefit, and in many cases, it's because they have an older plan that doesn't have this requirement.
What, if you might explain that, how do they then change out of that old plan into the requirements of law?
Mr. Chair, if they bought a new plan, the requirement would exist. It would exist for any non-grandfathered plan. But there are some carriers who are including these provisions in grandfathered plans as they make changes, their annual changes to policies. So we are seeing some of that happen, but it's not a requirement for those plans.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Would policy changes that trigger also apply to Taft-Hartley trusts or not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, I don't know the answer to that question. I can certainly find that out for you. Just to be clear, are you asking if an employer, if a self-insured were to make changes that triggered non-grandfathered status, are they okay? Yeah. Yes, I can find that out for you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm going to plead a little bit of ignorance here. I'm thinking a little confused in this. Maybe you can help me out. If you have a plan that listed certain preventative measures but not everything that might be considered preventative, and you were still on that plan, that would be considered a grandfather plan. Is that what you're telling us? But if the new plans come on, they come under a new preventative care benefit. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, if I as an individual purchased a plan before March 23rd, that plan is a grandfathered plan that wouldn't have to have the preventative care benefits at no cost sharing. If I buy a plan today, that plan is going to have those benefits. Does that answer your question?
Yes, and then follow up. Where can we get a list of those benefits?
The preventative benefits?
Yeah, I think there's a federal regulation involved in that, and I want to see what those look like.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, we've actually created a document that goes through the preventive benefits and actually compares them to Oregon mandates as well, and we have that on our website, and I can certainly send that to the committee and to you directly.
You anticipated, Mr. Chair, you anticipated my next question. How does that? I want to know how that lines up with the Oregon law and how we bring those together. Have you considered bringing that to us?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, one of the things that I think this body is going to need to look at, whether it's this session or next session or the 2012 session, is the issue of mandates. Given the subsidies that are available through the exchanges, one of the issues that I don't know is on a lot of people's radar is the issue of any state mandate that goes beyond the essential benefits as defined later this year by the feds. Any of those additional mandates will be something that the state will have to cover for people who get subsidies through the exchange. So there will then be a cost to the state if the state has benefits mandates that go beyond the essential benefits. So I think that is something that this body at some point is going to want to take a look at, is sort of and I think it'll probably need to happen after the federal government comes out with their regulations later this year. Once we get a complete list of all the essential benefits, I think there is going to have to be that comparison to state law, and I think at some point you all will need to make a decision about if we have state mandates that go further than those essential benefits, are we willing to pay for those for people who are getting subsidized through the exchange? If that makes sense.
A moving target.
Mm-hmm. A little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, I think one of the issues we've dealt with over the last year is the fact that the law, once it did pass, passed very quickly, and the timelines were very short. And so in many ways, the federal government has been trying to get regulations out, and states have been waiting to find out what is this provision really going to mean for us. And so there has been a lot of waiting in terms of finding out what the law really says and the impact it's going to have on states.
Okay. Any other question?
I was hoping we'd do law and we understand it before we pass it.
Okay. We do that once in a while.
I didn't hear the
statement.
Oh, I said I hope when we pass law, we understand it before we pass it. I think that would be a good thing. What triggers a change? An increase in rate, does that trigger change? We're grandfathering folks in. So does it have to be a specific, is it a benefit change that triggers grandfather or what?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, and Anthony, you can jump in. If you purchased your policy before March 23rd and you have a grandfather plan, the federal government has come out with regulations that indicate that if you make certain changes, and we can go through all of those if you want. For example, keeping your grandfathered status means you can't significantly cut or reduce benefits or drop coverage for a covered disease, for example. You can't raise coinsurance charges 20 to 25% or something like that. There are limits on raising fixed cost sharing, limits on co-payments. So there are certain guidance that the federal government has outlined, and if an insurer does those things, then it becomes a non-grandfathered plan. Does that make sense?
So you'll get us that sheet?
We can certainly get that for you.
That would be helpful.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
My understanding, and may well be, again, wrong, is that the essential benefits package may be available to us as early as late March this year. I doubt that's actually going to happen, but it's important to some of the things we're trying to put together in this session that don't take effect for a year or two. Do you have any idea when that might be available to us? Is there any indication you've heard from CMS on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, in terms of when the federal government will issue additional guidelines on essential benefits, is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Everything I've heard from talking to some federal officials in person to everything I've been reading from the federal government indicates it's going to be late this year, late 2011. So I have not heard anything that would indicate to me we'd see anything before September of this year.
Thanks.
But I also don't know how much I would bank on those timelines. We've tried to bank on those before, and it hasn't worked out well for us. So,
I mean, most of us would be happy for planning was by next February.
Yeah.
But the preventative measures are already listed for us. Is that correct?
I think that's right.
Yes, there's a excuse me, Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, there's a comprehensive list of preventative benefits.
So preventative benefits are here, overall benefits not yet, and probably not for a year. Okay, thanks.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
We're going to be dealing with a set of mandates in front of the House Health Committee on Monday. The only impact of having mandates beyond the essential benefit package at the moment has to do with state-paid health care. Is that just Medicaid? Is that OEB? I mean, OEB and PERS? Well, OEB and PERS isn't subsidized, so it's only subsidized.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, the way I understand it is, as far as the mandates work, if the state mandate exceeds the essential benefit that's required in coverage through the exchange, and an individual purchase is through the exchange and they have a subsidy, then the portion of that premium that would go to the mandate would have to be reimbursed to the individual or the, under some circumstances, to the insurer, depending on who pays or possibly the employer. But if there's a subsidy or a tax credit, that's when the state is kind of on the hook, if you will.
What about before?
Can I follow up?
Oh, I'm sorry.
I didn't understand the thing you just said.
Oh, I apologize.
Can you run that by again?
Sure. So prior to 2014, mandates, the cost of mandates wouldn't be an issue for the state as far as the Affordable Care Act. However, if coverage is purchased through the exchange and an individual is using a subsidy, a federal subsidy
federal
to
subsidy.
Purchase, or a tax credit to purchase, then the portion of the premium that is paid towards the mandate that goes above the essential benefit would have to be reimbursed by the state government that requires the mandate.
Reimbursed to whom?
The individual themselves or, under some circumstances, the insurer. So the state would either pay the insurer for that portion of the premium, or if the individual paid it, then they'd reimburse the individual.
Can I ask if you could send a memo to our committee, maybe before Monday afternoon? One paragraph.
One paragraph.
Sure, I'll try to make it clear.
Thank you.
And if you would include the members of the Senate.
Certainly.
Committee, so, including the full health care committee.
Mr. Chair, I think there's one mandate on autism this
coming up. Yeah.
Yeah, it's coming up. And so the fiscal impact statement we don't even have the exchange yet, so it's going to get complicated if we try to pass mandates this time not knowing then the cost to the state on how many of those are Medicaid. Yeah, okay.
Exactly.
All right, thank you.
This is a very complicated issue, and I struggled as well, Representative Greenlee, with following the logic of that. So I'm sure we'll have opportunity to understand that.
Over the next three years.
But one thing that would be helpful, if it wouldn't be too much to ask, would be just a simple bullet point of the key provisions and their effective dates, so that we understand what's immediate and then what's out in the future in those bullet points.
Mr. Chair, are you thinking about everything in the federal reform law?
Yes. There are actually
a lot of those out there, and I think we've got something on our website. A lot of entities have created such documents, so we wouldn't have to create it from scratch.
Okay, that would be helpful.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to make a guess how this is going to roll out, and you guys can correct me if you think it's going to be different than what I'm going to say. There's going to be probably a tax credit in 2014, January 1st. That tax credit will roll out, and it'll roll out for a essential benefit package offered by a group of insurers through some kind of an exchange. And we'll have to meet the essential benefit package that is, by that time, hopefully, defined by the federal government. Okay? If you want to go into that and try to figure out what part of that, let's say, for sake of argument, $400 credit that month was being applied against a mandate that was above and beyond the essential package put out by the federal government, have at it. I think it's going to be impossible to do. And what we're probably seeing is something like we have with the laws involved in building our highways. If you don't have a speed limit we like, or you don't build the way we like it, you lose your federal subsidy. My guess is that they'll say, you meet the essential package, you'll get your credit, but we're not going to try to go back and figure out, if you asked for more than that and made the premium too high, what you're going to do with that. That's going to be up to the state to figure out. And if you put your exchange together with too many mandates in it, and the premium's too high, you're going to have to sit back and say to yourself, why nobody wants to buy into the exchange. I think the market will decide this in the end. Does that make sense to you?
You may be right. I just
can't imagine going in and trying to figure out on a $400 credit what piece goes to where. I mean, my God. You know, how are you going to do that? We can't even hardly understand it here. Try it every month with what you're trying to buy, or some poor company trying to buy for its employees. I just doubt that'll be part of the package.
Mr. Chair, can I comment on this one? Yeah, I mean, it seems to me the real issue on the base is going to be whether we want to have any mandates in it.
Yeah, beyond the essential package.
Beyond the essential benefit package.
Yeah.
I mean, once we're defining essential benefit package, it would seem that that ought to be a pretty good benefit package. And maybe you can get supplementary insurance for some things, but...
Or maybe your platinum program will have things you can buy up to if you want to spend more money for it, but the essential package will be your bronze, and that'll be the way you go. I think you got to simplify this thing somewhere. I mean, we could make it more complex. I just don't know how to do it.
Yeah, I'm not looking for ways.
Yeah,
you know, Winston Churchill said that the Americans usually end up doing the right thing, but not until they've tried everything else first.
Well, we'll hope better than that.
We're ready to
move
on?
Yes, please move on.
Okay, we'll talk next about rescissions. The federal law prohibits insurance companies from rescinding coverage unless an enrollee commits fraud or makes an intentional misrepresentation of a material fact on an application. And this is a tougher standard than exists currently in Oregon law. Oregon law now allows health policies to be canceled, non-renewed, or rescinded for unintentional misrepresentation of material fact. So existing federal law limits cancellation or non-renewals for misrepresentation to intentional misrepresentation of a material fact, and the Affordable Care Act extended that to rescissions. So we're just going to have one standard for both, or for all canceled, non-renewed, and rescinded policies, and it'll have to be intentional misrepresentation. The reforms also require a 30-day advance notice to the policyholder of any planned rescission, and Senate Bill 89 conforms Oregon law to the federal law regarding these provisions around rescissions. Our bill also requires insurers to notify DCBS of any rescission within 30 days. One part of the federal law that received a lot of attention was an insured's right to external review, or an independent review of a claims denial. Oregon law already has a strong external review process, but the federal law will extend some of these same rights to enrollees in self-insured plans. Insurers who offer comprehensive health benefit plans in Oregon must allow enrollees to appeal denials of coverage to what we call an independent review organization. These IROs are independent of the insurance company. Policyholders ask their insurer for this review, but the insurance division randomly assigns the case to a review panel. And the person or people who review medical records and other relevant materials are independent of the insurance company. They review the insurance company's decision to see if they made the correct decision. The federal government has deemed Oregon's external reviews, review laws and required processes temporarily compliant with the federal law, and this means that until July 1 of this year, when all the federal external review requirements kick in, Oregon's external review requirements will control. We will only need to make very few changes to Oregon's external review laws, and those changes are included in Senate Bill 89.
It's an IRO decisions are binding, so that's the end of the line.
Right.
So no ALJ or anything like that coming after it.
They're binding on the plan, but not necessarily on the... There's still legal rights beyond that, aren't there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, Representative Green, they're binding on the plan, however, they're not... The insurer has to agree to be bound, not the... not the claimant. The claimant could continue to appeal.
Would that be through, do administrative law judges come in at that point, or does it go directly to the circuit?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, that is not an administrative process, so it would be a civil lawsuit.
Okay.
Cost sharing for out-of-network emergency services under the new law cannot exceed cost sharing for in-network emergency services. But out-of-network emergency services, the provider may require the insured to pay the difference between the amount billed by the provider and the amount paid by the insurer and the insured in many cases, either through coinsurance or copayment. Oregon law doesn't now provide a specific level of coverage for emergency services, but Oregon law is not consistent with this provision, so our bill doesn't suggest making any changes to Oregon law based on this provision.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Have you defined, thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you defined emergency services?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, our Senate Bill 89 does not make changes to Oregon's existing definition of emergency services. It is basically in line with the federal law. It wouldn't conflict.
So moving on to rate review. As I mentioned earlier, Oregon already reviews and approves rate increases for small employers and individual plans and rejects unreasonable increases. And given the recent HHS or federal government regulations, it appears that the law will have very little impact in states like Oregon that already have a strong rate review process in place. The regulation leaves it up to states with strong rate review processes to determine whether a rate in the small group and individual insurance markets is unreasonable. And those regulations don't apply to large groups. And the law did not give the federal government any new authority to reject rates. So to the extent that authority exists, it remains with the state, to the extent the state has that authority.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, not everybody believes we have a strong rate review process, as I'm sure you've heard from some. Will this take place inside the exchange as well as outside the exchange? And will it take place exactly the same way?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, that's a very good question. At this point, our rate review process would extend, unless there's some change, it would extend to plans that are offered both inside and outside the exchange.
Under the same rules?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
And speaking of the exchange, I just included this, even though this is not part of Senate Bill 89. This is part of Senate Bill 99, which will be brought forward to you by the Oregon Health Authority. But they are developing the details of the federally mandated exchange, which will be a central marketplace where small employers and individuals can more easily find and compare health insurance policies. And I think, as most of you know, people eligible for subsidies to offset the cost of health insurance have to purchase their insurance through exchanges. But again, We've been assisting the Oregon Health Authority in developing this, but we are certainly, we're not in the lead on that, so you'll hear that from the Oregon Health Authority. Cost impact. I think it's important to note that in the short term, we are seeing slight increases in health insurance rates to cover the cost of the additional benefits that were provided beginning last fall. In Oregon, these additional benefits have typically accounted for no more than 4% of a rate increase. So the impact has been relatively small, but certainly has had some impact. And, of course, in the longer term, federal reform intends to reduce health insurance costs by making people healthier and reducing the amount of cost shifting that happens today.
Could you explain, Teresa, how your understanding of the measure, how it would reduce the cost?
Mr. Chair,
because the reason I raise this is this really is the heart of the problem.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chair, I think as I included on the slide there, I think part of the goal there is the more people that you have insured, the less cost shifting you have because you don't have as many people going to the emergency room, for example, who don't have coverage. So that takes away some of that cost shifting. But I didn't pass the law, Mr. Chair, so I don't know exactly what they had in mind, but I think that's part of it. I think the more people you have insured, the less cost shifting you expect to see. But that gets to the issue, of course, of whether the individual mandate will be effective and whether the penalties associated with that mandate are strong enough to make it be an effective mandate. And I think there are a lot of folks who have concerns about whether or not it's strong enough.
But in our market, and I suspect it's the same in other states, about 50-55% of the payer mix is Medicaid, Medicare. That is
true.
Underpayment and, in fact, reducing reimbursements.
Mm-hmm.
Where will that bulge go?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to bring to the committee's attention that there's not only a cost shift between Medicaid payments and Medicare payments and uninsured to the private insurers, but there's also a cost shift amongst private insurers. Some reimburse more adequately than others, I've come to understand. So you have some providers, particularly in what I've noticed in primary care, that reimburse primary care quite well, and others that don't value it quite as much. And it has, in many ways, those carriers that do reimburse well in primary care or subsidizing the private insurers who don't. I also wanted to call the committee's attention to recent trends that might not have shown up yet in the insurance division filings that I've noticed in pretty significant decrease in medical utilization as noticed in the earnings statements of Cigna, Aetna, United Health, and HealthNet, the big insurers. So medical utilization has been going down over the course of the year. And according to the PPI, their medical inflation is also stabilizing. So that's something that we, I think, should keep in mind as we move forward on this.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'd like to go directly to your question.
Just thinking about an exchange is keeping utilization down, aren't you?
I'm sorry?
Just thinking about an exchange is keeping utilization down.
Mr. Chair, I might go directly to your question, and maybe I can help here, Teresa, a little bit out of a quandary. The numbers I've looked at, and they're very anecdotal in some ways, that until we get to 2014, as we roll this out in 2011, 12, and 13, the likelihood of us affecting cost shift is pretty low. If you think about this carefully, you understand why. One is, who are the 26-year-olds who are likely to be insured by their parents, the ones that are probably got a problem? For the most part, that age group is really, really, really healthy, but many people will not do that because it's extra cost to the family, and they're probably going to look at primarily people who are potentially going to have a problem. Same with children being rolled out. The Children First program we've got going is going to help some out there. But everything I see rolling out right now is going to be adverse selection for insurers, and that's going to go on for 2 or 3 years. Maybe a small amount, but an adverse selection. Mm-hmm. The real cost drivers for this are other ones. So probably 15% of our costs are our cost shift. Remembering in some states, Medicare is the best payer available above and beyond commercial insurance and more than pays for its cost. We're in a state that is at the bottom of the pile. We don't come near close to our Medicare reimbursement rates for the actual cost of care. And of course, Medicaid's the same way. So cost shift in this state is really significant compared to others because of our Medicare program, especially in a state that is an aging state, an older state. So we've got a lot of different factors pushing on this hydraulic. Mm-hmm. And while I'm supportive of what's going on here, I wish it had been rolled out as a package or within 12 months of the program, not delayed as we went along in such a way that I think we're going to put some extra pressure on the healthcare system financially instead of doing it up front, getting it done. But I don't have a vote at that level.
Nor do I.
And I'm not going to get one. So just so we're prepared and thinking that way, that this is going to be, I think, a more difficult time between now and 2014. Plus, there's a chance it may all go away. Senator Cruz. I doubt that it will, but it could. So we've got a lot going on here.
Yeah. Okay, Mr. Chair, I was just going to briefly mention the 2014 reforms. Again, these are not part of what we're bringing before the committee in Senate Bill 89, but just to look forward to 2014, unless something changes, of course. We do have the individual mandate requiring most Americans to purchase coverage by 2014, and we have the subsidies available or the tax credits available to individuals as well as small businesses who purchase through the exchange. And, of course, large employers.
Mr. Chair?
Excuse me.
Yeah. On the individual tax credits, how will that work? Is it going to be based on income? Does everyone get a tax credit no matter what? All of that kind?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moss Anderson, I believe there are income requirements. Well, I know there are income requirements for
this.
That's what
I've heard, yes.
Isn't there a small employer tax credit of 50 or fewer, and it has to do with the average wage of all of the employees in that firm?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's correct. I believe it's 24. I want to say 25 or fewer. I actually have a very helpful chart that shows you how it phases out as income and employees rise. So I'll provide that. I think that'd be helpful.
We'll have a propagation of many small businesses, big businesses becoming small businesses.
Big business becoming small businesses, yeah.
Yeah.
We're going to immediately split my company in 2014.
Yeah.
My memory of this is, if I may, again, and correct me if I'm wrong, in broad terms for individuals, Medicaid will roughly go up to 200% of the federal poverty level, which would bring them into the exchange that form. 200 to 400% gets the subsidy, and it's a graduated subsidy. And after 400%, there's no more subsidies, but you can still buy into the exchange.
That's right.
And for employers, we could go as high as 100 employees into the exchange, depending on how we decide to do that and what it looks like as far as costs are concerned and what the benefit package looks like. We haven't even seen that yet, obviously, so
right. It's
complex.
Mm-hmm.
I missed it if you said, when is the exchange required by law to be implemented?
2014.
January 1st.
And you know we're receiving pushback from that date. From carriers saying we shouldn't be doing it so quickly.
Mr. Chair, Senator Moniz Anderson, so the way the federal law was written, if states don't have exchanges up and running in 2014, the federal government will have an exchange up and running in your state in 2014.
And we forego the subsidy of whatever it is.
Right,
there's absolutely no reason not to do it unless federal law changes.
Even right. though it's unconstitutional, I guess that's okay.
That'll be tested.
It will be tested, yes.
A lot yet to be determined. Please proceed.
So, Mr. Chair, this is my last slide. While I had the chance, I thought I'd mention that DCBS has been working very closely with the Oregon Health Authority in developing a new website called Oregon Health Connect to provide consumer assistance in helping them find resources that are available out there. We have a key feature of the website is a resource directory that lists all the various government and community programs that help people with either health insurance or health care. It is definitely a work in progress, but we continue to add to that resource page, and we'll be getting the word out there about this website. So I just wanted to mention that as well. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions or comments?
How come she always looks, so awake. And fresh. I don't understand that.
And it's 4 o'clock Thursday afternoon.
Free day.
Thank you very much. Before you leave, just one other thing. Work group that convened last night and talking about how do we essentially reset and improve our public-assisted health programs. And the discussion focused, Representative Greenlake, on what's the true cost of the reductions as anticipated. And as was presented in the handout, it was something just shy of $900 million of general funds with some match of federal funds that we would forego, if I recall the discussion.
Well, 1.6, it would be about $2.5
billion. $2.5
billion. So $2.5 billion.
Not true.
If in fact, that money was not available and taken out of the system, my question would be, from an insurance rate increase, what would be the impact of that kind of a shock cost shift on the rates to commercial payers? And my concern is that would we have the ability to just, not ability, the unfortunate outcome of collapsing the insurance market, the commercial insurance market, if you pull $2 billion out of the Oregon health providers, what does that do to the rates, and consequently, what does it do to those who are, you know, purchasing health care?
I'm not sure I was following the beginning part of your question. I wasn't a part of the discussion last night, so I'm not sure exactly what was talked about, so I'm sorry. I'm not following that.
Well, help me, those of
you. Yeah,
that's
a great question. I don't thought, Mr. Chair, that's a great question. We have, let's say we have $20 billion a year that we spend in health care in Oregon, and a big chunk of that is in the Oregon Health Plan, the Medicaid program, and that's people who are insured in the plan, even at low rates, but insured and taken care of on a preventive basis when we look at it. What if we just pulled $2 billion out of that and either made those people uninsured or cut rates to providers so low that they wouldn't see them unless it was made up the commercial side? So we have a $2 billion increase in cost shift, maybe even higher because those people now would be going to ERs, no health insurance, maybe it ballooned to an actual meaningful $3 million loss. What does that do to commercial rates? Knowing that in that $20 billion figure we got, we've got Medicare in there, Medicaid in there, probably $7 or $8, $9 billion in commercial rates, and we just dump another $3 billion on top of them, or $2 billion on top of them. That's a great question.
Well, see,
and it could collapse the market. I mean, nobody could afford the insurance rate. Is that what you're getting to?
Yeah, that's exactly my concern is...
And I'm
telling you, the providers will not absorb $2.5 billion.
Right.
They can't.
Right.
So where does it go? And the only place it can go is the commercial.
No, Mr. Chair, I think you bring up a really good point. I think it's exacerbated by the fact that we've seen declines in the commercial market in terms of enrollment. So you've got fewer and fewer people in the commercial market that are going to be absorbing that. But
absolutely, I see that every month.
Right, right.
When you look at the payer mix.
We are too, yeah.
And it's dropping. So is there some way that we could engage your services to look thoughtfully at the implications of that kind of an unwinding of essentially money that's now in the system, if it was not in the system, what are the consequences?
Absolutely.
Because I could see a virtual catastrophe emerging.
Right. Absolutely.
That's such a far-reaching catastrophe because not only do you end up saying, well, we have to take it out of the race, but the fact is that's taking $2.5 billion out of the Oregon economy, period, which has huge multiplier effects. You know, every $1 billion in federal funds that comes in represents 30,000 jobs. You take $2 billion out of that, you're affecting 60,000 jobs in this state, which has all kinds of other consequences. That's the point I was trying to make, and I tried to make it with the governor today. He sort of bypassed it, but I don't think the state can survive that immediate $2.5 billion shortfall.
Well, there are unintended consequences, and it would behoove us to try to figure out
absolutely
if, in fact, this is a potential we better factor that into our decision making.
Right.
Because I could see this thing just imploding.
It's especially difficult for us in Oregon because we're a donor state to the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
So that $2 billion that we don't get is our money going to other states that will get it.
Right.
And so we're shipping money out of Oregon and other states to the tune of $1.5 to $2 billion, depending on how you want to calculate it, but it's a huge chunk.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't thought from that point. I'm sort of down the weeds here thinking how we're going to maintain a system. You're thinking a little bigger picture. What does it do to our entire healthcare industry and to our state?
Mm-hmm.
There is a way out. We all know what it is. I won't say it here. Okay.
We're going to work on that.
There is a way out. There's two ways out. Okay.
Yeah.
And either one would work. And so yours would work long term. Mine would work short term. And I will hook up maybe someday and see what happens. Even Senator Cruz, I think, he agrees with this one down there.
Mm-hmm. Well, if there's some way that you could inform our subcommittee and both House and Senate health care committees with a thoughtful analysis of the what-ifs.
We can certainly take that back and take a look at it, see what we can do.
Okay.
I appreciate the thoughtful discussion.
Be happy to visit with you further. And,
that sounds great.
And refine with
what you're looking for.
A couple of our colleagues here as to really what kind of parameters that we need
okay.
to consider.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, can I ask you another question?
Yes.
Just slightly off topic now that we have her here. We all know one of the big problems with health insurance rate increases isn't this stuff. It's stock market losses that have to be made up in other ways. The stock market's gone really well the last mm-hmm. 2 years. Can we expect decreases in health insurance premiums, not counting this other stuff, in the next year? And is that something you're going to be telling them to expect?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, you bring up a really good issue. And if you remember 2 years ago, part of House Bill 2009 included a provision that allows the department to look at surplus investment income and overall profitability of a company when we're making decisions in individual rates. And I'll tell you that we have seen investments bounce back for a lot of companies, and we have been taking that into account when we review rates. I will also tell you, though, as I presented this to Senator Shields' committee yesterday, if you look at the profitability of companies overall, and investment income is a very big part of that, if you look at overall profitability today, companies are doing better today than they have over the last few years. If you look at the profitability in the lines of business that we regulate, the small group and individual lines of business, companies on average are losing money in those lines of business. So we are, and frankly, we have in some cases pared down or pushed back on insurers, even in cases where they were losing money in that line of business because they had healthy surplus levels and because their investment income was doing well. So we are taking that into account. I think consumers in Oregon today are benefiting from the fact that you all passed that law last session that allows us to look at that.
But that depends on the allocation models. And my impression is they like to allocate profits to the lines of business that they want and allocate losses to the lines of business they don't want.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, we look at the amount of money that the company is bringing in premiums and the amount going out in claims, so we can get a good sense of whether they're making money or losing money in that line of business. And again, today, many carriers are losing money in those lines of business when you're just looking at how much premium they're bringing in, how much they're paying out in claims. And they're essentially subsidizing those regulated markets today with investment income, with surplus, and with profits from other lines of business.
Well, this is an arcane discussion, and we don't want to take it up now. We'll take it up again. But the fact is those lines of business help support the overall fixed costs of those companies. And, I mean, there are accounting methods that make them look like losses. And you said, okay, do you want to get those out of the way? Would you become much more profitable? The answer is they would not become much more profitable. You got those out of the way, they'd have to allocate fixed costs that maybe represent 10 or 25% of their business to these other areas. And I just fret over these are nonprofit corporations that are supposed to have social missions,
mm-hmm.
and they exhibit those social missions in very odd ways. But I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, this is This is offline for this discussion. I expect Senator Shields is going to clean this whole thing up in his committee. By the time it gets to the House, I won't have any problems at all with health insurance.
Right. You should come to my committee on Monday at 1 o'clock.
I'd love to if I weren't in Ways and Means Subcommittee.
Okay, well, thank you. Well, I suspect this will be the beginning of a lot of interesting discussion before we wrap our arms around this issue. Thank you very much for coming, and I look forward to visiting with you and trying to figure out what this big picture impact is.
Hey, Chip.
Its impact on the insurance market.
I do as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify today? We will be bringing this bill back in the future. But I would suggest that since we are in suspense with respect to the the Insurance Commission, DCBS statutes, and the exchange, that we will not meet until we have bills before us.
Okay, let us know.
Okay.
Thank you again.
Well, thank you. And with that, we're adjourned.
Thank you.